Listeners, are you married? Or do you have a partner in your life? Or are you single, perhaps widowed or divorced? Well, no matter what your marital status, you're going to be interested in this next conversation because you're going to find out how your marital status may affect your health and your longevity. And to have that conversation, we have a returning guest, Dr. Paula Treif. It's been a long time since you were here.
Yeah, it has been. A couple of years at least.
A couple of years. And actually, that ties into our conversation this morning in a way, too, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We're glad to have you back. And I want to remind listeners that you're a professor in psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate. And you're also in the midst of some studies that talk about the health relationship to diabetes, right?
That's right. That's
so
right.
Before we talk about that specifically, I want to talk about this article that was in the New York Times that had to do with marriage and health. We'll talk about the article and the science behind it, and then we'll come back and talk about what you're finding and how that can relate to some real action steps patients can actually take.
Okay.
Does that sound good?
Sounds good.
All right. So it seems like, according to this article, a happy marriage sets the stage for a healthier life. And the emphasis was on a happy marriage. And some research was done over, I guess, a number of different kinds of research that showed, and I'm going to quote here, that married people are less likely to get pneumonia, have surgery, develop cancer, or have heart attacks. They're at lower risk for dementia. And then one conclusion from a study done of 24 cases of death in the Netherlands found that virtually every category ranging from violent deaths like homicide and car accidents to certain forms of cancer, the unmarried were at a far higher risk than the married.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big statement to make.
There's a lot of evidence, and actually the article goes back to the first person who identified this in 1858, and they called it the marriage advantage. But there's a lot of evidence that people who are married compared to the unmarried, single, have better health outcomes overall.
Well, you know, some of the questions, and my initial thing would be, how exactly did they measure this? Because in my own experience, I'm divorced. I wouldn't say that I was in a happy marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Did that have even a worse effect? I mean, there are different ways of looking at this, and that's what I want to talk to you about. How was this measured?
Well, it moved from the studies that you're talking about here really just looked at marital status. So they just compared people who were married to people who were single, essentially.
No matter what?
No matter how happy they were.
Exactly.
But as the field has evolved, people have recognized that it really is not just marital status, but it's actually the quality of the relationship. And that the subsequent research, more like in the 80s and 90s, I would say, talks more about people being in relationships where they feel satisfied, as you said, happy, and looking at whether that relates to their health status, and it does. Mostly that's measured by questionnaires. So there are some standardized questionnaires, marital satisfaction inventory, marital quality inventory. Those are the kinds of names they have. And there are a series of questions where they ask you to rate, very often to rate on some kind of a scale, how satisfied are you with different aspects of your relationship? How satisfied are you with how you work out the finances, with how you're raising your children, with how your sex life is going? And they go through the different domains of most marriages, and people self-report, essentially, of how satisfied they are.
Well, I would look at that as an outside observer and say to you, I don't think there's a whole lot of science behind a questionnaire like that. I look at it as, yes, there are going to be some people who are very sincere in their answers, and there are going to be others who are sitting next to their spouse and they don't dare answer it
No, they're careful about that.
Oh, they are. Okay,
They're careful about that. They don't have them fill it out where their spouse is sitting
right
there. All right,
but, you anonymous. Know, I was fascinated, though, in this article, it reports on some physical measures of those kinds of things. So tell us about a couple
of
those.
So then the field kind of moved to, maybe because, as you said, the science is a little squishy with self-report questionnaires, then the field moved to saying, well, maybe it's not just how satisfied you are in your marriage, but what actually occurs in your relationship, how you interact with each other. And so the studies that have been done most recently are really fascinating, and they're studies mostly that have been done by Jan Kiekel-Glaser and her husband, Dr. Kiekel-Glaser, I don't remember his first name. And their research is in the field of psychoneuroimmunology.
So, say that again.
So psychoneuroimmunology.
All right, let's break that down. Psychological, of course.
Neuro is the neurological system, and
the brain.
Mm-hmm. And immunology is the immune system,
sure.
The system that protects us from illness.
Now that sounds like quote-unquote real science, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's certainly measurable.
Yes. It's the physical and the emotional and mental together.
Yes.
Okay.
Looking at how does psychological factors mm-hmm. like stress or depression or anxiety, how do psychological factors affect this the workings of the brain and the workings of the immune system?
The physical body.
Yeah, that's yeah. right.
And how did they run those tests?
Well, the study around the marital conflict issues were, they did a couple of interesting studies. One, they looked at a group of newly married, newlyweds who were ostensibly seemed to be happy in their marriages, and they had them interact initially about some situation that caused them conflict, talk about problems with money or mm-hmm. problems with their in-laws or whatever would cause them conflict. And while they were doing that, they measured their immune system. And what they're measuring there is the natural killer cell production. Natural killer cells are the cells that bite off, or
they
fight old Pac-Man that yeah. fight disease.
Yeah, and right. I love that Pac-Man. I should mention right. to people, I really believe that we all started understanding immunology and epidemiology once Pac-Man was invented.
That's right. That's absolutely
we can see,
right.
And because they do. They kill the disease in the body.
That's right.
Okay.
And so the one way that we measure the functioning of the immune system, there's a normal level that they should be at, and then there's a depletion or when they're low and, mm-hmm. and of course, when they're high.
And so they were measuring. They were taking blood tests.
They were taking blood tests as they were having these discussions. They
yeah.
actually had the person had their arm kind of in a little cubicle almost, and they were and their blood was being drawn periodically as they were having these discussions.
Uh-huh.
And what they found was that when these happily married couples were having discussions that were conflicted situations, their immune system was depressed. They produced fewer natural killer cells.
And so even though they were happy.
Even though they were overall happy and would on all those questionnaires would uh-huh. have said, I'm very well satisfied.
Yeah.
Even then, when they were having these high conflict discussions, their immune system went down. And when they were having as compared to when they were having the benign discussions or the positive discussions where that wasn't affected. That's really paralleled other kinds of studies, psychoneuroimmunology studies. So there are studies where they find that students during exam time have decreased natural killer cell
activity. And we kind of know that because it seems like students always get sick right about the
right.
time. The end of the year activities. They've got too much going on.
Yeah.
And maybe they're happy with them, maybe they're not, but they're stressful.
Yeah, I think we know that, but I don't think we necessarily knew that our immune system was being affected. I think we always say, well, you're not sleeping enough or you're not eating
right.
well. But I don't think until they start studying these kinds of, really at this basic level of the natural killer cells, that we actually knew that it affects the immune system.
And
found
that really
that with
is
accountants
a...
during tax season, their
sure.
immune system is decreased as well.
And you know, and I know moms always seem to get sick around the holidays.
Right.
You know, they're doing
right.
all the shopping and they're doing all the cooking and maybe dad's cooperating too, but it just seems like everybody gets sick. That's
right.
partially a factor. They're indoors too, and so those germs are being
right.
passed around.
So we know that there's, because we're always being exposed to germs and bacteria and viruses, so it's really how we fight it off that matters.
Well, you know, there's a whole lot more to this conversation, more about these studies and then more about how it affects us in our marriages.
Mm-hmm.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we want to look really at some work you're doing specifically around this area, and then maybe some of the things we can do, those of us who have a relationship or don't, to improve our health base on it. So listeners, we're going to take a break. Please stay with us. This is Upstate's Health Link on air on 570 WSYR. Welcome back to HealthLink On Air, produced each week by Upstate Medical University and University Hospital. This is your host, Tricia Torrey, Every Patient's Advocate, having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Paula Treif from Upstate Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences. We were talking about psychoneuroimmunology, which is a lot easier for you to say than it is for me to say. But it's that study of what goes on in the physical body as we also measure what's going on in the brain.
Right.
And we were talking about some of the science behind how these tests are being made in stress and how it relates to health, marital status, how it relates to stress, and
mm-hmm.
how it relates to health. So you were telling us about these blood tests
right.
on couples who were...
So another really interesting study, quickly, that the Kiko Glazers did was that they did a similar kind of thing where they had couples talking about conflicted situations and then benign situations. But in these situations, what they had done is they created a very small blister on the forearm of the individual. Of the
yeah,
patient.
They've got a machine that creates
machine
blisters.
They have a little suction cup, and it just yeah. makes a little blister. It doesn't really hurt them or anything, and they know that it's going to happen. So it creates a little blister.
Mm-hmm.
And then they looked at how long it took for those blisters to heal.
And on the inside of your arm, you don't even think of getting blisters
right.
there to
it's
begin
just,
with.
Yeah, I'm not sure why that's why they
yeah.
chose that area, but
yeah.
it's probably just easier to fit into the machine.
Uh-huh.
But what they found was that when couples following these conflicted situations or discussions, that it took actually a whole day longer for the blisters to heal than in comparison to how long it took following these benign situations. And also that couples who already had, who had a lot of hostility in that conflict, did actually took them 2 days longer to heal.
Isn't that amazing?
That was really fascinating to me. Very, very interesting.
Which you really can then translate to say, I mean, it's very simple for somebody who's even as unscientific as I am to then say, I can see now physical evidence that conflict and stress really does negatively affect your health.
Right.
So now let's go back to what that original idea was that if you're in a marriage, you're going to be healthier than if you're not in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say then that that's really been refined, that that's not really,
yes,
you know, marriage might define happiness, but maybe it doesn't?
Yes. No, it's definitely been refined. And now it's really much more about how you interact and as it's progressed, how you deal with conflict in your interaction. Every marriage is going to have some conflict. Every relationship are going to have, people are going to have things they disagree about. So it's not that you can avoid that or even that you want to avoid that. You're too individuals, and
right,
that's what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's how you manage it. And there was a subsequent, another study, which I didn't even know about until I read the article, that talked about the importance of affection when somebody is experiencing conflict or experiencing stress.
Yes, and there was a measurement of that, too.
There was a measurement of the actual brain activity.
Yes.
And they found that when people were experiencing pain, they gave them a little shock that they're, if they were holding the hand of a stranger, that the area of the brain that experiences pain was a little less active than it was when they were not holding the hand of a stranger.
So
but
just holding the hand of a stranger helped.
Hand, but holding the hand of their partner helped significantly more. That there was, again, in the functioning of the brain, not in neurons, we don't know. We just know that what lights up in the brain,
right,
essentially, in the functioning of the brain. So they started to talk about, it's, again, not about just being married, but about hostility, the absence of hostility, and then the, on the positive side, the presence of affection.
The affection.
It may make a difference.
Absolutely. So I guess what that boils down to then is a recognition that if you share the stress, you know, if you trust, if you respect, if you love somebody else, you can really rely on that person to help pull you through stressful times.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, oh, what's the saying about trouble shared is trouble halved, or mm-hmm, something like that.
Something,
I know,
like
my
that.
Grandmother said it better than that. But, you know, I think even in terms of little things, if something's wrong with the pipes,
mm-hmm,
well, I might be the one who calls the plumber, but my husband might be the one who deals with the plumber.
Mm-hmm.
Now we've just shared that, and
that's right,
it's not as stressful a circumstance
that's
as it
right
might have been.
That's right. That's
now
right.
Let's talk about your research. You were here 2 years ago. We mentioned that early on.
Mm-hmm.
You were getting ready to start a program that was a relationship between relationships, marriage relationships,
mm-hmm,
and diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to us about what your premise was as you started, and
okay,
where you are 2 years later.
Okay. So that, given all the evidence that we're talking about, we thought that it would be important to see if we work with patients and their partners, whether that would have a more beneficial effect for the patient's health,
mm-hmm,
given that the absence of that kind of support seems to have a negative effect.
And patients who have diabetes.
Right. So, and our work is specifically focused on type 2 diabetes, although there have been studies looking at cardiovascular disease and smoking cessation and arthritis, et cetera. That's not unique. But our work is specifically focused on patients who have type 2 diabetes. So our small pilot was a patient, was an intervention for patients who have type 2 diabetes who are in poor blood sugar control.
Right.
And
they're not controlling it well.
Right, meaning that it's high.
Yes.
That their blood sugars are kind of consistently high. If you have type 2 diabetes, the number is hemoglobin A1C. That's a measure of blood sugar
right
control. And so if your hemoglobin A1C is 7.5% or higher for our studies, that's actually 7% or higher is considered poor blood sugar control. So we wanted
okay
a little higher to give them some room to improve. And what we did was we had three groups. One group received basic diabetes education alone. One group received diabetes education plus individualized work towards improving their blood sugar, testing themselves.
Still alone?
Still alone.
Okay.
And then one group received the same, but together with their partners.
Okay.
And then in the intervention with their partners, we also had them work on their communication. How could they talk and speak and listen more effectively to each other?
Mm-hmm.
How can the partner support the person who has diabetes?
Mm-hmm.
It's all done on the telephone because we're trying to reach people who couldn't traditionally take off from work and come into an academic health center, and it's especially difficult because you're recruiting patients and partners, so you need
sure
two people.
Sure.
And so our pilot was quite promising. It showed, yes, that it was beneficial But it wasn't
that
clear.
What was beneficial?
Well, so the intervention was beneficial.
Uh-huh.
Good question.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't clear that the couple's intervention was more beneficial than the individual. But
really?
It was a very small pilot. And the purpose of the pilot was really to prove, is this feasible and acceptable? Can you do it? And do patients want to do it? And will they sign up and participate?
And really let's even take the bigger picture. We know we've just come through all the health care reform and the new bill. Is it worthwhile spending the money for patients to make that happen?
Right.
We can't just assume that it's better to have the partner involved.
That's right.
And
that's
so
right.
Why
There's no evidence at this point that it's better to have a partner.
There's
a little bit of evidence, but very, very little. There's evidence that if your partner is there, that you might do a little better, but then you could say, well, the people whose partners come already are going to do better.
Yes.
You know, so in this case, we are randomly assigning them. So each group, the patient and the partner, have to be willing to participate, even though only in one-third of those groups, of the groups, will the patient, will
now,
the partner participate.
Did you find a big difference between those patients who you were just doing the initial inventory of what their situation versus the ones who were taught the interventions on their own? Did you find a difference in there?
I'm not sure I understand.
Well, you said you had two groups. The first group was just people who, you only taught them how to test their
education.
Blood. Right, okay.
Right.
And what was the second group?
Oh, the individual intervention and then the couple's intervention.
Okay,
yes,
so
the intervention, the two intervention groups, the individual and the couples, mm-hmm. generally did better than the ones who just got education, although the people who just got good education also did improve.
They did?
They did.
Okay.
And that just speaks to the fact that a lot of people don't have access to really good education.
Sure. So we can take it back to that and just say that education seems to be a good thing.
That's right.
All right.
That's right.
Did you find...
We also found, and I just want to add this, that even in the groups where the patient and where the partner was not supposed to participate, some of the partners did participate. You know, we didn't feel like we could tell them you can't.
Right.
And so some of them would be on the calls. We actually had a questionnaire now that asks, how much did your partner participate? Some of them read, we gave them big workbooks with a lot of materials. We mm-hmm. gave them homework assignments. Again, they signed up because they were looking for a couple's intervention. So some of them, the partner did participate.
Oh, yeah.
So that makes it a little fuzzy.
Well, you know, I have to wonder, when you start involving the spouse or the partner, and again, that was about marriage, but it wasn't about marriage. That was about two people invested in each other's well-being, or at least one person invested in the other one's well-being. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily, again, a marriage, because
that's
I've got to think that there would be, for instance, gay partners who would be together,
that's right.
who would be happy. There might even be a parent and an adult child, or an adult with their own child,
right.
you know, those kinds of relationships that you could come out with the same kinds of outcomes.
That's right. Well, actually, in the studies, in the one that we're doing now, too, we do not limit it to married mm-hmm. partners. We limit it to people who have been in a committed relationship for at least a year, and they really define whether it's a committed relationship. So they could be gay couples. They could be people who don't live together. That's fine. And since it's a phone intervention, we can, you know, conference call everybody in if we need to, that kind of thing. We have not included the situations with parents and their adult children or friends. That certainly is worth looking at, but in terms of a study, we wanted to really try to focus on people in a committed relationship.
But if I look at this, taking that article that we started with that was saying that married people are happier, and then I listen to what you're having to say, the conclusion I really draw, and again, I don't have all the evidence, but the conclusion I draw really is that about if you have a support system, if you have education, and your support system could be your spouse or your partner, then your health outcomes are going to be better. Not necessarily that you have that piece of paper that says you're married.
It's absolutely not related to the piece of paper.
There
we know
you go.
That. And even if you're if you have that piece of paper, then as we were saying earlier, that if it's a hostile relationship or one where you don't know how to deal with conflict, that actually can be deleterious to your health. So it's not an absolute cause effect. There are a zillion factors that affect this, but it's one piece of the puzzle. And we do know that the way I think of it is this. We do know that your partner is going to affect what happens with you in your health.
Yes.
And that you and your health are going to affect your partner. That's just inevitable. And so what we're trying to do in this intervention is to foster that in a positive direction.
Yes. Because they're going to affect whether you want them to or not.
Right.
And they could have a good effect or a bad effect. So let's work toward that effect.
That's right.
Well, Dr. Paula Treif, thank you so much for coming by this morning. This has been fascinating. You are still looking for people in your program,
yes,
right?
Yes, we're actually just getting started now on the larger 5-year study to really, really test this.
You are. And how can people get in touch if they'd like to participate?
The best way would be to contact our research assistant, and her number is 464-5619.
Very good.
If people lose that, they can certainly contact me, Dr. Paula Treif, mm-hmm. at Upstate, and I'm in the faculty directory, or you can call me 464 3120.
Okay, or they could probably even call Upstate Connect and be connected to you. And that's 464-8668. And that's a number we give all the time.
Oh, good.
And we'll also put information on our HealthLink On Air website.
Great, thank you.
Very good. Dr. Paula Treif, this has been fascinating.
Thank you.
And I hope that what this means is that people are going to start working on those communications and getting some of the stress out of their lives.
Certainly hope so.
Very good. Listeners, we are going to take a break. Please do stay with us. This is Upstate's HealthLink On Air on 570 WSYR.